Side 5, down below station by C.J. Terry, continuing on page 146. What do you figure? Maybe it was a little close in there. A lot of the refugees panic at crowding. It scarred into them. But I didn't come in with the refugees, he said. I remember that. And what else? A tick jerked at his face. He rose, began to dress, and after a moment Damon did likewise. Other men came and went about them. Shouts from outside reached into the room when the door opened, the ordinary noise of the gym. "Do you really want me to take you to the hospital?" Damon asked, finally. He shrugged into his jacket. "No, I'll be all right." He judged that such was the case. Although his skin was still drawn in chill, the clothes should have warmed away. Damon frowned, gestured toward the door. They walked out into the cold outer chamber, entered the lift with half a dozen others, rode at the dizzying straight drop into outer shell G. Josh drew a deep breath, staggered a little in walking off, stopped as the flow of traffic swirled about him. Damon's hand closed on his elbow, moved him gently in the direction of a seat along the corridor wall. He was glad to sit down, to rest a moment, and watch the people pass them. They were not on Damon's office level, but on a green one. The strains of music from the concourse floated out to them from the far end. They should have ridden it on down, had stopped, Damon's idea. Near the track around to the hospital, he reasoned, or just a place to rest. He sat, taking his breath. A little dizzy, he confessed. Maybe it would be better if you went back, at least for a checkup. I should never have encouraged you to this. It's not the exercise. He bent, rested his head in his hands, drew several quiet breaths, straightened finally. Damon, the names. You know the names in my records. Where was I born? Saitin. My mother's name. Do you know it? Damon frowned. No, you didn't say. Mostly you talked about an aunt. Her name was Mavis. The older woman's face came to him again, a warm rush of familiarity. I remember. Had you forgotten even that? The tick came back to his face. He tried not to acknowledge it, desperate for normalcy. I have no way to know, you understand, what's memory and what's imagination or dreams. Try dealing with things when you don't know the difference and can't tell. The name was Mavis. Yes. You lived on a farm. He nodded, treasuring a sudden glimpse of sunlit road, a weathered fence. He was often on that road in his dreams, bare feet in slick dust, a house, a prefab and peeling dome. Many such, field upon field, ripe gold in the sun. Plantation. A lot larger than a farm. I lived there. I lived there until I went into the service school. That was the last time I was ever on a world, wasn't it? You never mentioned any other. He sat still a moment, holding on to the image, excited by it, by something beautiful and warm and real. He tried to recover details, the size of the sun in the sky, the color of sunsets, the dusty road that led to and from the small settlement. A large, soft, comfortable woman and a thin, worried man who spent a lot of time cursing the weather. The pieces fit, settled into place. Home. That was home. He ached after it. Damon, he said, gathering courage, for there was more than the pleasant dream. You don't have any reason to lie to me, do you? But you did. When I asked you for the truth a while ago about the nightmare. Why? Damon looked uncomfortable. I'm scared, Damon. I'm scared of lies. Do you understand that? Scared of other things. He stammered uncontrollably, impatient with himself, with muscles that jerked and a tongue that would not frame things and a mind like a sieve. Give me names, Damon. You've read the record. I know you have. Tell me how I got to Pell. When Russell's collapsed, like everyone else. No, starting with Saitin, give me names. Damon laid an arm along the back of the bench, faced him, frowning. The first service you mentioned was a ship named Kite. I don't know how many years. Maybe it was the only ship. You'd been taken off the farm, I take it, into the service school, whatever you call the place, and you were trained in Armscomp. I take it that the ship was a very small one. Scout and recon, he murmured, and saw in his mind the exact boards, the cramped interior of Kite, where the crew had to hand over hand their way in zero-G. A lot of time at Fargon Station, a lot of time there, and out on patrol, out on missions, just looking for what they could see. Kitha. Kitha and Lee. Childlike Kitha. He had had particular affection for her. And Ulf. He recovered faces, glad to remember them. They had worked close, in more than one sense, for the dark ships had no cabins, no privacy. They had been together years. Years. Dead now. It was like losing them again. Watch it, Kitha had yelled. He had yelled something too, realizing they were blind-spotted. Ulf's mistake. He sat helpless at his board, no guns that would bear on the threat. He flinched from it. They picked me up, he said. Someone did. A ship named Tigris hit you, Damon said. Rider ship, but it was a freighter in the area that homed in on your capsule signal. Go on. Damon stayed silent a moment as if he were thinking on it, as if he would not. He grew more and more anxious, his stomach taut. You were brought onto station, Damon said finally, aboard a merchanter, a stretcher case, but no injuries. Shock, cold, I suppose. Your life support had started to fade, and they nearly lost you. He shook his head. That much was blank, remote and cold. He recalled docks, doctors, interrogation, endless questions. Mobs. Shouting mobs. Docks and a guard falling. Someone had coldly shot the man in the face while he lay on the ground, stunned. Dead everywhere, trampled, a surge of bodies before him, and men about him, armored troops. They've got guns, someone had shouted, and panic broke out. You were picked up at Mariner, Damon said, after it blew, when they were hunting Mariner survivors. Eileen, they questioned you at Russell's, Damon said softly, doggedly. They were facing, I don't know what. They were frightened, in a hurry. They used illegal techniques like adjustment. They wanted information out of you, timetables, ship movements, the whole thing, but you couldn't give it to them. You were on Russell's when the evacuation began, and you were moved to this station. That's what happened. A dark umbilical from station to ship. Troops and guns. On a warship, he said. Norway. His stomach knotted. Mallory. Mallory and Norway. Grass. He remembered. Pride died there. He became a nothing. Who he was, what he was, they had not cared among the troops, the crew. It was not even hate, but bitterness and boredom. Cruelty in which he did not matter. A living thing that felt pain, felt shame. Screamed when the horror became overwhelming, and realizing that there was no one at all who cared. Stopped screaming, or feeling, or fighting. Want to go back to them? He could hear even the tone of Mallory's voice. Want to go back? He had not wanted that. Had wanted nothing then but to feel nothing. This was the source of the nightmares, the dark, confused figures, the thing that wakened him in the night. He nodded slowly, accepting that. You entered detention here, Damon said. You were picked up. Russell's, Norway, here. If you think we've thrown anything false into your adjustment, no. Believe me. Josh? He was sweating, felt it. I'm all right, he said, although it was hard for a moment to draw breath. His stomach kept heaving. Closeness, emotional or physical, was going to do this to him. He identified it now, tried to control it. Sit there, Damon said, rose before he could object, and went into one of the shops along the hall. He rested there obediently, head against the wall behind him, his pulse easing finally. It occurred to him that it was the first time he had been loose alone, save for the track between his job and his room in the old hospice. Being so gave him a peculiarly naked feeling. He wondered if those who passed knew who he was. The idea frightened him. You will remember some things, the doctor had told him when they stopped the pills. but you can get distance from them. Remember some things. Damon came back, bringing two cups of something, sat down and offered one to him. It was fruit juice and something else, iced and sugared, which soothed his stomach. "You're going to be late getting back," he recalled. Damon shrugged and said nothing. "I'd like..." To his intense shame, he stammered, "to take you and Aline to dinner. I have my job now. I have some credit above my hours." Damon studied him a moment. "All right. I'll ask Aline." It made him feel a great deal better. "I'd like," he said further, "to walk back home from here, alone." "All right." "I needed to know what I remember. I apologize." "I'm worried for you," Damon said, and that profoundly touched him. "But I walk by myself." "What night for dinner?" "You and Aline decide. My schedule is rather open." It was poor humor. Damon dutifully smiled at it, finished his drink. Josh sipped the last of his and stood up. "Thank you." "I'll talk to Aline, let you know the date tomorrow. Take it easy. And call me if you need." Josh nodded, turned, walked away, among the crowds who might know his face. Like those on the docks in his memory, crowds. It was not the same. It was a different world, and he walked in it, down his own portion of hall as the newfound owner of it. Walked to the lift along with those born to Pell, stood with them waiting on the lift car as if he were ordinary. It came. Green 7. He spoke up for himself when the press inside cut him off from the controls, and someone kindly pressed it for him. Shoulder to shoulder in the car. He was all right. It whisked him down to his own level. He excused his way past passengers who gave him not a second glance, stood in his own corridor near the hospice. "Tally," someone said, startling him. He glanced to his right at uniformed security guards. One nodded pleasantly to him. His pulse raced and settled. The face was distantly familiar. "You live here now?" the guard asked him. "Yes," he said, and an apology. "I don't remember well from before. Maybe you were there when I came in." "I was," the guard said. "Good to see you came out all right." He seemed to mean it. "Thank you," Josh said, walked on his way and the guards on theirs. The dark which had advanced retreated. He had thought them all dreams. "But I don't dream it," he thought. "It happened." He walked past the desk at the entry to the hospice, down the corridor inside to number 18. He used his card. The door slid aside and he walked into his own refuge, a plain, windowless place, a rare privilege from what he had heard of Vid about the overcrowding everywhere. More of Damon's arranging. Ordinarily, he would turn on the vid, using its noise to fill the place with voices, for dreams filled the silences. He sat down now on the bed, simply sat there a time in the silence, probing the dreams and the memories like half-healed wounds. Norway. Signe Mallory. Mallory. Part 4. Pell, White Dock, Lucas Company offices, 1830 hours, 0630 hours, alter day, alter dawn. There were no disasters. John stayed in the office, rearmost of all the offices, took normal calls, worked his routine of warehousing reports and records, trying in one harried corner of his mind to map out what to do if the worst happened. He stayed later than usual, after the lights had dimmed slightly on the docks, after a good deal of the first shift staff had left for the day, and the main day activity had settled down. Just a few clerks out in the other offices to answer comm, and 10 things till the alter day staff came in. Swan's eye went out unchallenged at 1446. Annie and the Culins left with Vittorio's papers at 1703, without question or commotion more than the usual close inquiries about schedules and routing for the militia. He breathed easier then. And when Annie had long since cleared the vicinity of the station, beyond any reasonable chance of protest, He took his jacket, locked up, and headed home. He used his card at the door to have every minutest record in comp as it should be, found Jessad and Hale sitting opposite one another in silence in his living room. There was coffee, soothing aroma after the afternoon tension. He sank into a third chair and leaned back, taking possession of his own home. "I'll have some coffee," he told Bran Hale. Hale frowned and rose to go fetch it. And to Jessad, "A tedious afternoon?" "Gratefully tedious," Jessad said softly. "But Mr. Hale has done his best to entertain." "Any trouble getting here?" "None," Hale said from the kitchen. He brought back the coffee, and John sipped at it, realized Hale was waiting. "Dismiss him, and sit alone with Jessad." He was not eager for that. Neither was he eager to have Hale talking too freely, here or elsewhere. "I appreciate your discretion," he told Hale. "And with a careful consideration, you know there's something up. You'll find it worth your while more than monetarily. Only see you keep Lee Quayle from indiscretions. I'll fill you in on it as soon as I find out more. Vittorio's gone. Dayan's lost. I've need of some reliable, intelligent assistance. You read me, Bran?" Hale nodded. "I'll talk with you about this tomorrow," he said then, very quietly. "Thank you." "You all right here?" Hale asked. "If I'm not," he said, "you take care of it. Here?" Hale nodded, discreetly left. John settled back with somewhat more assurance, looked at his guest, who sat easily in front of him. "I take it you trust this person," Jessad said, "and that you want to promote him in your affairs. Choose your allies wisely, Mr. Lucas." "I know my own." He drank a sip of scalding coffee. "I don't know you, Mr. Jessad, or whatever your name is. Your plan to use my son's ID I can't permit. I've arranged a different cover for him. A tour of Lucas' interests, a ship's outbound for the mines, and his papers are on it." He expected outrage. There was only a polite lift of the brows. "I have no objection, but I shall need papers, and I don't think it wise to expose myself to interrogation obtaining them." "Papers can be gotten. That's the least of our problems." "And the greatest, Mr. Lucas?" "I want some answers. Where's Dayan?" "Safe behind the lines. No cause for worry. I'm sent as a contingency, an assumption that this offer is valid. If not, I shall die, and I hope that's not the case." "What can you offer me?" "Pell," Jessad said softly. "Pell, Mr. Lucas." "And you're prepared to hand it to me?" Jessad shook his head. "You're going to hand it to us, Mr. Lucas. That's the proposal. I'll direct you. Mine is the expertise, yours the precise knowledge of this place. You'll brief me on the situation here." "And what protection have I?" "My approval." "Your rank?" Jessad shrugged. "Unofficial. I want details. Everything from your shipping schedules to the deployment of your ships to the proceedings of your council, to the least detail of the management of your own offices." "You plan to live in my apartment the whole time?" "I find little reason to stir forth. Your social schedule may suffer for it. But is there a safer place to be? This Bran Hale, a discreet man?" "Worked for me on down below. He was fired down there for upholding my policies against the Constantines. Loyal."
"Reliable?"
"Hale is. Of some of his crew, I have some small doubt, at least regarding judgment."
"You must take care, then."
"I am."
Jessad nodded slowly.
"But find me papers, Mr. Lucas. I feel much more secure with them than without."
"And what happens to my son?"
"Concerned? I'd thought there was little love lost there."
"I asked the question.
There's a ship holding far out, one we've taken, registered to the Olvik Merchanter family, but in fact military. The Olviks are all in detention, as are most of the people of Swan's Eye. The Olvik ship, Hammer, will give us advance warning, and there's not that much time, Mr. Lucas. First, will you show me a sketch of the station itself?"
Mine is the expertise. An expert in such affairs, a man trained for this. A terrible and chilling thought came on him, that Viking had fallen from the inside, that Mariner, on the other hand, had been blown. Sabotage from the inside. Someone mad enough to kill the station he was on, or leaving. He stared into Jessad's nondescript face, into eyes quite implacable, and reckoned that on Mariner there had been such a person as this. Then the fleet had shown up, and the station had been deliberately destroyed. Part 5. Pell, Q Zone, Orange 9, 1900 hours. There were still people standing in line outside, a queue stretching down the Niner Hall out onto the dock. Vasily Kresich rested his head against the heels of his hands as the most recent went out in the ungentle care of one of Kaledi's men, a woman who had shouted at him, who had complained of theft, and named one of Kaledi's gang. His head ached, his back ached. He abhorred these sessions, which he held, nevertheless, every 5 days. It was at least a pressure valve, this illusion that the counselor of Q listened to the problems, took down complaints, tried to get something done. About the woman's complaint, little remedy. He knew the man she had named. Likely it was true. He would ask Nino Coletti to put the lid on him, perhaps save her from worse. The woman was mad to have complained. A bizarre hysteria, perhaps, that point which many reached here, when anger was all that mattered. It led to self-destruction. A man was shown in. Redding, next in line. Kresich braced himself inwardly, leaned back in his chair, prepared for the weekly encounter. "We're still trying," he told the big man. "I paid," Redding said. "I paid plenty for my pass." "There are no guarantees in down-below applications, Mr. Redding. The station simply takes those it has current need of. Please put your new application on my desk, and I'll keep running it through the process. Sooner or later, there'll be an opening." "I want out." "James!" Kresich shouted in panic. Security was there, instantly. Redding looked about wildly, and to Kresich's dismay, reached for his waistband. A short blade flashed into his hand, not for security. Redding turned from James. "For him." Kresich flung himself backward on the chair's track. Death James hurled himself on Redding's back. Redding sprawled face down on the desk, sending papers everywhere, slashing wildly as Kresich scrambled from the chair and against the wall. Shouting erupted outside, panic, and more people poured into the room. Kresich edged over as the struggle came near him. Redding hit the wall. Nino Coletti was there with the others. Some wrestled Redding to the ground. Some pushed back the torrent of curious and desperate petitioners. The mob waved forms they hoped to turn in. "My turn," some woman was shrieking, brandishing a paper and trying to reach the desk. They herded her out with the others. Redding was down, pinned by three of them. A fourth kicked him in the head, and he grew quieter. Coletti had the knife, examined it thoughtfully, and pocketed it, a smile on his scarred young face. "No station police for him," James said. "You hurt, Mr. Kresich?" Coletti asked. "No." He discounted bruises, felt his way to his desk. There was still shouting outside. He pulled the chair up to the desk again and sat down, his legs shaking. "He talked about having paid money," he said, knowing full well what was going on, that the forms came from Coletti and cost whatever the traffic would bear. "He's got a bad record with station, and I can't get him a pass. What do you mean, selling him an assurance?" Coletti turned a slow look from him to the man on the floor and back again. "Well, now he's got a bad mark with us, and that's worse. Get him out of here. Take him out down the hall, the other way." "I can't see any more people," Kresich moaned, resting his head against his hands. "Get them out of here." Coletti walked into the outer corridor. "Clear it out." Kresich could hear him shouting above the cries of protest and the sobbing. Some of Kaledi's men began to make the move, armed, some of them with metal bars. The crowd gave back, and Coletti returned to the office. They were taking Redding out the other door, shaking him to make him walk, for he was beginning to recover, bleeding from the temple in a red wash which obscured his face. They'll kill him, Krasich thought. Somewhere in the less trafficked hours, a body would find its way somewhere to be found by station. Redding surely knew it. He was trying to fight again, but they got him out and the door closed. Mop that up, Coletti told one of those who remained, and the man searched for something to clean the floor. Coletti sat down again on the edge of the desk. Krasich reached under it, brought out one of the bottles of wine with which Coletti supplied him. Glasses. He poured two, sipped at the downer wine, and tried to warn the tremors from his limbs, the twinges of pain from his chest. I'm too old for this, he complained. You don't have to worry about Redding, Coletti told him, picking up his glass. You can't create situations like that, Krasich snapped. I know what you're up to, but don't sell the passes where there's no chance I'll be able to get them. Coletti grinned, an exceedingly unpleasant expression. Redding would ask for it sooner or later. This way he paid for the privilege. I don't want to know, Krasich said sourly. He drank a large mouthful of the wine. Don't give me the details. We'd better get you to your apartment, Mr. Krasich. Keep a little watch on you, just till this matter is straightened out. He finished the wine at his own rate. One of the youths in Coletti's group had gathered up the stack of papers the struggle had scattered about the floor and laid it on his desk. Krasich stood up then, his knees still weak, averted his eyes from the blood which had tracked on the matting. Coletti and four of his men escorted him through that same back door which had received Redding and his guards. They walked down the corridor into the sector in which he maintained his small apartment, and he used his manual key. Comp had cut them off, and nothing worked here but manual controls. I don't need your company, he said shortly. Coletti gave him a wry and mocking smile, parodied a bow. Talk with you later, Coletti said. Krasich went inside, closed the door again by manual, stood there with nausea threatening him. He sat down finally in the chair by the door, tried to stay still a moment. Madness accelerated in Q. The passes which were hope for some to get out of Q only increased the despair of those left behind. The roughest were left, so that the temperature of the whole was rising. The gangs ruled. No one was safe who did not belong to one of the organizations, man or woman. No one could walk the halls safely unless it was known he had protection, and protection was sold, for food or favors or bodies, whatever the currency available. Drugs, medical and otherwise, made it in, wine did, precious metals, anything of value, made it out of queue and into station. Guards at the barriers made profits. And Coletti sold applications for passes out of queue, for down below residency. Sold even the right to stand in the lines for justice, and anything else that Coletti and his police found profitable. The protections gang reported to Coletti for license. There was only the diminishing hope of down below, and those rejected or deferred became hysterical with the suspicion that there were lies recorded about them in station files, black marks which would keep them forever in queue. There were a rising number of suicides. Some gave themselves to excesses in the barracks halls, which became sinks of every vice. Some committed the crimes, perhaps, of which they feared they were accused, and some became the victims. They kill them down there, one young man had cried, rejected. They don't go to down below at all. They take them out of here and kill them. That's where they go. They don't take workers. They don't take young men. They take old people and children out, and they get rid of them. Shut up, others had cried, and the youth had been beaten bloody by three others in the line before Coletti's police could pull him out. But others wept and still stood in line with their applications for passes clutched in their hands. He could not apply to go. He feared some leak getting back to Coletti if he put in an application for himself. The guards were trading with Coletti, and he feared too much. He had his black market wine, had his present safety, had Coletti's guards about him, so that if anyone was harmed in Q, it would not be Vasily Krasich, not until Coletti suspected he might be trying to break from him. Good came of what he did, he persuaded himself. While he stayed in Q, while he held the fifth-day sessions, while he at least remained in a position to object to the worst excesses, some things Coletti would stop, some things Coletti's men would think twice about, rather than have an issue made of them. He saved something of order in Q, saved some lives, saved a little bit from the thing Q would become without his influence. And he had access to the outside, had that hope always, if the situation here became truly unbearable, when the inevitable crisis came, he could plead for asylum, might get out. They would not put him back to die, would not. He rose finally, hunted out the bottle of wine he had in the kitchen, poured himself a quarter of it, trying not to think of what had happened, did happen, would happen. Redding would be dead by morning. He could not pity him, saw only the mad eyes of the man staring at him as he lunged across the desk, scattering papers, slashing at him with a knife. At him, and not at Colady's guards. As if he were the enemy. He shuddered and drank his wine. Part 6. Pell, Downer Resident, 2300 Hours. Change of Workers. Satin stretched aching muscles as she entered the dimly lit habitat, stripped off the mask, and washed fastidiously in the cool water of the basin provided for them. Bluetooth, never far from her day or night, followed and squatted down on her mat, rested his hand on her shoulder, his head against her. They were tired, very tired, for there had been a great load to move this day, and although the big machines did most of the work, it was Downer Muscle which set the loads on the machines and humans who did the shutting. She took his other hand and turned it palm up, mouthed the sore spots, leaned close and gave a lick to his cheek where the mask had roughed the fur. Lucas men, Bluetooth snarled. His eyes were fixed straight forward and his face was angry. They had worked for Lucas men this day, some who had given the trouble down below at the base. Satin's own hands hurt and shoulders ached, but it was Bluetooth she worried for with this look in his eye. It took much to stir Bluetooth to real temper. He tended to think a great deal, and while he was thinking, found no chance to be angry, but this time she reckoned he was doing both, and when he did lose his temper, it would be bad for him among humans with Lucas men about. She stroked his coarse coat and groomed him until he seemed calmer. "Eat," she said. "Come eat." He turned his head to her, lipped her cheek, licked the fur straight, and put his arm about her. "Come," he agreed, and they got up and walked through the metal tunnel to the big room where there was always food ready. The young ones in charge here gave them each a generous bowlful, and they retreated to a quiet corner to eat. Bluetooth managed good humor at last with his belly full, sucked the porridge off his fingers in contentment. Another male came trailing in, got his bowl, and sat down by them, young big fellow, who grinned companionably at them, consumed one bowl of porridge, and went back after his second. They liked big fellow, who was not too long ago from down below himself, from their own riverside, although from another camp and other hills. Others gathered when big fellow came back, more and more of them, a bow of warmth facing the corner they sat in. Most among them were seasonal workers who came to the up above and returned to down below again, working with their hands and not knowing much of the machines. These were warm toward them. There were other Hysa beyond this gathering of friends, the permanent workers, who did not much speak to them, who sat to themselves in the far corner, who sat much and stared, as if their long sojourning among humans had made them into something other than Hysa. Most were old. They knew the mystery of the machines, wandered the deep tunnels, and knew the secrets of the dark places. They always stayed apart. "Speak of Bennett," Bigfellow asked, for he, like the others who came and went, whatever the camp which had sent them on down below, had passed through the human camp, had known Bennett Jacent, and there had been great mourning in the up above when the news of Bennett's death had come to them. "I speak," Satin said. For she, newest here, had the telling of this tale among tales that the Hysa told in this place, and she warmed quickly to the story. Every evening since their coming, the talk had not been of the small doings of the Hysa, whose lives were always the same, but of the doings of the Constantines, and how Emilio and his friend Maliko had made the Hysa smile again, and of Bennett, who had died the Hysa's friend. Of all who had come to the up above to tell this tale, there was none to tell it who had seen, and they made her tell it again and again. He went down to the mill, she said, and when she came to that sad time in the story, and he tells the Heiser there, no, no, please run, humans will do, humans will work, so river takes no Heiser. And he works with his own hands, always, always, Bennett man would work with his own hands, never shout, no, loves the Heiser. We gave him a name, I gave, because he gave me my human name and my good spirit. I call him Comes From Bright. There was a murmuring at this, appreciation and not censure, although it was a spirit word for son himself. Heiser wrapped their arms about themselves in a shiver, as they did each time she told this. And the Heiser do not leave Bennett man, no, no. They work with him to save the mill. Then old River, she is angry with humans and with Heiser, always angry, but most angry because Lucas man make bare her banks and take her water. And we warn Bennett man he must not trust old River, and he hears us and come back. But we Heiser, we work, so the mill will not be lost and Bennett not be sad. Old River, she come higher and takes the posts away, and we shout, quick, quick, come back, for the Heiser who work. I satin, I work there, I see. She thumped her chest and touched Bluetooth, embellishing her tail. Bluetooth and satin, we see, we run to help the Heiser, and Bennett, and good man, his friends, all run to help them. But old River, she drinks them down, and we come too late in running, all too late. The mill breaks, st, and Bennett, he reaches for Heiser in arms of old River. She takes him, too, with mans who help. We shout, we cry, we beg old River, give Bennett back, but she takes him all the same. All Heiser she gives back, but she takes Bennett man and his friends. Our eyes are filled with this. He dies. He dies when he holds out arms for the Heiser. His good heart makes him die, and old River, bad old River, she drink him down. Humans find him and bury him. I set the spirit sticks above him and gave him gifts. I come here, and my friend Bluetooth comes, because it is a time. I come here on pilgrimage, where is Bennett's home. There was a murmured approval, a general swaying of the bodies which ringed them. Eyes glistened with tears. And a strange and fearful thing had happened, for some of the strange up-above Heiser had moved into the back fringes of the crowd, themselves swaying and watching. He loves, one of them said, startling others. He loves the Heiser. So, she agreed. A knot swelled into her throat at this admission from one of the terrible strange ones, that they listened to the burden of her heart. She felt among her pouches her spirit gifts. She brought out the bright cloth and held it in gentle fingers. This is my spirit gift, my name he gives me. Another swaying and a murmur of approval. What is your name, storyteller? She hugged her spirit gift close to her breast and stared at the strange one who had asked, drew in a great breath. Storyteller. Her skin prickled at such an honor from the strange old one. I am Sky Sees Her. Humans call me Satin. She reached a caressing hand to Bluetooth. I am Sun Shining Through Clouds, Bluetooth said. Friend of Sky Sees Her. The strange one rocked on his haunches, and by now all the strange Heiser had gathered to a muttering of awe among the others, who gave way to leave an open space between them and her. We hear you speak of this Comes From Bright, this Bennett man. Good, good was this human, and good you gave him gifts. We make your journey welcome, and honor your pilgrimage, Sky Sees Her. Your words make us warm, make warm our eyes. Long time we wait. She rocked forward, respecting the age of the speaker and his great courtesy. There were increasing murmurs among the others. This is the old one, Big Fellow whispered at her shoulder. He does not speak to us. The old one spat, brushed his coat disdainfully. The storyteller speaks sense. She marks a time with her journey. She walks with her eyes open, not only her hands. Ah, the others murmured, taken aback, and Satin sat dismayed. We praise Bennett Jacent, the old one said. He makes us warm to hear these things. Bennett man is our human, Big Fellow said staunchly. Down below human, he sent me here. Loved us, another said, and another, all loved him. He defended us from Lucas's, Satin said. And Constantine Man is his friend. Send me here for my spring, for pilgrimage. We meet by Bennett's grave. I come for great sun, to see his face, to see thee up above. But, old one, we see only machines, no great brightness. We work hard, hard. We do not have the blossoms or the hills, my friend and I know, but we still hope. Bennett says here is good, here is beautiful. He says great sun is near this place. We wait to see, old one. We asked for the images of the up above, and no one here has seen them. They say that humans hide them away from us, but we still wait, old one. There was long silence while old one rocked to and fro. Finally he ceased and held up a bony hand. Sky sees her. The things you seek are here. We visit there. The images stand in the place where human old ones meet, and we have seen them. Sun watches over this place. Yes, that is true. Your Bennett man did not deceive you. But there are things here that will make your bones cold, storyteller. We do not speak these secret things. How will Hysa down below understand them? How will they bear them? Their eyes do not see, but this Bennett man made warm your eyes and called you. Ah, long we wait, long, long, and you make warm our hearts to welcome you. St. Up above is not what it seems. The images of the plain we remember. I have seen them, I have slept by them and dreamed dreams. But the images of up above, they are not for our dreaming. You tell us of Bennett Jacent, and we tell you, storyteller, of one of us you do not see. Lily, humans call her. Her name is Sun Smiles on her, and she is the great old one, many more than my seasons. The images we gave humans have become human images, and near them a human dreams in the secret places of the up above, in a place all bright. Great Sun comes to visit her. Never moves she, no, for the dream is good. She lies all in bright. Her eyes are warm with sun. The stars dance for her. She watches all the up above on her walls, perhaps watches us in this moment. She is the image which watches us. The great old one cares for her, loves her, this holy one. Good, good is her love, and she dreams us all the up above, and her face smiles forever upon great sun. She is ours. We call her Sun her friend. Ah, the gathering murmured, stunned at such a thing, one mated to great sun himself. Ah, Satin murmured with the others, hugged herself and shivering, leaned forward. Shall we see this good human? No, said old one shortly. Only Lily goes there. And myself, once I saw. Satin sank back, profoundly disappointed. Perhaps there is no such human, Bluetooth said. Now old one's ears lay back, and there was an intake of breath all about them. It is a time, said Satin, and my journey. We come very far, old one, and we cannot see the images, and we cannot see the dreamer. We have not yet found the face of sun. Old one's lips pursed and relaxed several times. You come. We show you. This night you come. Next night others, if you are not afraid. We show you a place. It has no humans in it for a short time. 1 hour. Human counting. I know how to reckon. You come? From Bluetooth there was not a sound. Come, Satin said, and felt his reluctance as she tugged at his arm. Others would not. There were none so daring or so trusting of the strange old one. Old one stood up, and two of his company with him. Satin did, and Bluetooth stood up more slowly. I go too, Big Fellow said, but none of his companions came with him to join them. Old One surveyed them with a curious mockery and motioned them to come down the tunnels into the further ways, tunnels where Hysa could move without masks, dark places where one must climb far on thin metal and where even Hysa must bend to walk. He is mad, Bluetooth hissed finally into her ear, panting. And we are mad to follow this deranged old one. They are all strange who have been here long. Satin said nothing, not knowing any argument but her desire. She feared, but she followed, and Bluetooth followed her. Big Fellow trailed along after all of them. They panted when they must go a long way bent or climb far. It was a mad strength that the old one and his two fellows had, as if they were used to such things and knew where they were going. Or perhaps, the thought chilled her bones, it was some bizarre humor of the old one to strand them deep in the dark ways, where they might wander and die lost, to teach the others a lesson. And just as she was becoming convinced of that fear, the old one and his companions reached a stopping place and drew up their masks, indicating that they were at a place which would break into human air. Satin swept hers up to her face, and Bluetooth and Bigfellow did so only just in time, for the door behind them closed, and the door before them opened on a bright hall, white floors and the green of growing things, and here and there scattered humans coming and going in a lonely, large space, nothing like the docks. Here was cleanliness and light, and vast dark beyond them, where Old One wished to lead them. Satin felt Bluetooth slip his hand into hers, and Bigfellow hovered close to both of them as they followed, into a darkness even vaster than the bright place they had left, where there were no walls, only sky. Stars shifted about them, dazzling them with emotion, magical stars which changed from place to place, burning clear and more steadily than ever down below saw them. Satin let go the hand which held hers and walked forward in awe, gazing about her. And suddenly light blazed forth, a great burning disk, spotted with dark, flaring with fires. "Sun," Old One intoned. There was no brightness, no blue, only dark and stars and a terrible close fire. Satin trembled. "There is dark," Bluetooth objected. "How can there be night where sun is?" "All stars are kindred of bright sun," said Old One. "This is a truth. The brightness is illusion. This is a truth. Great sun shines in darkness, and he is large, so large we are dust. He is terrible, and his fires frighten the dark. This is truth. Sky Caesar, this is the true sky. This is your name. The stars are like great sun, but far, far from us. This we have learned. See, the walls show us the up above itself, and the great ships, the outside of the docks, and there is down below. We are looking on it now." "Where is the human camp?" Bigfellow asked. "Where is Old River?" "The world is round like an egg, and some of it faces away from the sun. This makes night on that side. Perhaps if you looked closely, you might see Old River. I have thought so. But never the human camp. It is too small on the face of down below." Bigfellow hugged himself and shivered. But Satin walked among the tables, walked into the clear place where great sun shone in his truth, overcoming the dark. Terrible he was, orange like fire, and filling all with his terror. She thought of the dreaming human called Sun her friend, whose eyes were forever warmed with that sight, and the hair lifted on her nape. And she stretched wide her arms and turned, embracing all the sun and his far kindred, lost in them, for she had come to the place which she had journeyed to find. She filled her eyes with the sight as sun looked at her, and she could never be the same again, forever. Chapter 4. Aboard Norway, Null Point, Union Space, 9:10:52. Omicron Point. Norway was not the first to come flashing into the vicinity of that dark, planet-sized piece of rock and ice, visible only as it occluded stars. Others had preceded her to this sunless rendezvous. Omicron was a wanderer, a bit of debris between stars, but its location was predictable, and it provided mass enough to home in on out of jump. A place as nowhere as it was possible to be, a chance finding by Sung of Pacific long ago, used by the fleet since then. It was one of those bits that the sublight freighters had dreaded, which jump ships with private business to conduct cherished and kept secret. Sensors were picking up activity, multiple ship presence, transmissions out of this forever night. Computer talked to computer as they came in, and Signe Mallory kept her eyes flickering from one to the other bit of telemetry, fighting the hypnotism that so easily set in from jump and the necessary drugs. She hurled Norway into real space max, heading for those signals and out of the jump range with a sense of something on her tail, trusted her crew's accuracy, and aimed with the ship underway the flickering few minutes of heart-in-throat transit near sea, where all they had was approximation. She cut it back quickly, started dumping velocity, no comfortable process, and the slightly speed-mad telemetry and slightly drug-mad human brain fought for precise location. Overestimate that dump, and she could take Norway right into that rock or into another ship. Clear, clear. All in now but Europe and Libya, Comm reported. No mean feat of navigation to find Omicron so accurately, to come in within middle scan, right in a jump range, after a start from near Russell's, far away. Fail their time, and they would have been in the jump range when something else came in, and that was disaster. Good job, she sent to all stations, looking at the reckoning graph flashed to her center screen. 2 minutes off mark, but dead on distance. Can't cut it much closer at our starting range. Good signals being received. Stand by. She took her pattern in relation to Omicron, checked through data. Within the half hour, there was a signal from Libya, which had just come in. Europe came in a quarter hour after that, from another plane. That was the tale of them, then. They were in one place at one time, which they had not been since their earliest operations. Unlikely as it was, Union would come in on them in strength here, they were still nervous. Computer signal came in from Europe. They were given breathing space to rest. Signe leaned back, took the comm plug from her ear, unharnessed, and got up finally, while Graf moved to the post she had vacated. They were not at the disadvantage of some. Norway was one of the main day ships, her main command staff on the schedule they were following now. Others, Atlantic, Africa, and Libya, were alter day, so that strike hours were never remotely predictable, so that there were ships with their main crews available on either schedule. But they were all main day now, a synchronization they had never undergone, and the alter day captains did the suffering, jump and reverse hours combined. Take over, she bade Graf, wandered back through the aisle, touched a shoulder here and there, walked back to her own nook in the corridor, passed it by. She walked on back instead to crew quarters, looked in on them, alter day crew, most drugged senseless, to get their rest despite jump. A few, having an aversion to that procedure, were awake, sat in the crew main room, looking better than they probably felt. All stable, she told them. Everyone all right? They avowed so. They would drug out now, safe and peacefully. She left them to do that, took the lift down to the outer shell and the troop quarters, walked to the main corridor behind the sitting area, stopped in one barracks after another, where she interrupted knot after knot of men and women sitting and trading speculations on their prospects, guilty looks and startled ones, troopers springing to their feet in dismay to find themselves under her scrutiny, a frantic groping after bits of clothing, a hiding of this and that which might be disapproved. She did not, but the crew and troops had some quaint reticences. Some here, too, slept drugged, unconscious in their bunks. Most did not. Gambled in many a compartment, while the ship shot her own dice with the deep, while flesh and ship seemed to dissolve, and the game continued on the other side of a far-stretched moment. "Going to be a bit slow down here," she would say in each case. "We're in pattern, and we're all stable, at your ease down here, but keep yourselves within a minute's prep for moving. No reason to think there's a problem, but we take no chances." Dai Jans intercepted her in the main corridor after the third such visit. Nodded courtesy, walked with her through this private domain of his, seeming pleased in her presence among his command. Troops braced when Dai walked with her, came to blank attention. Best, she thought, to pull the pretended inspection, just to let them know command had not forgotten them down here. What was coming was the kind of operation the troops dreaded, a multiple-ship strike, which raised the hazard of getting hit. And the troops had to ride it out blind, useless, jammed in a small safety the inner structure of the ship could afford them. They were no braver when it came to walking into possible fire, boarding a stopped merchanter, landing in some ground raid, and they took in stride the usual strike, Norway sweeping in alone, hit and run. But they were nervous now. She had heard it in the muttered comments which filtered over open comm, always open, Norway tradition, that they all knew what was going on down to the newest trooper. They obeyed, would obey, but their pride was hurt in this new phase of the war, in which they had no use. Important to be down here now, to make the gesture. Queasy as they were with jump and drugs, they were at their lowest, and she saw eyes brighten at a word, a touch on the shoulder in passing. She knew them by name, every one, called them by name, one and another of them. There was Mahler, whom she had taken from Russell's refugees, looking particularly sober and no little frightened. He, from a merchanter. Di had come years ago the same way. Many, many more. Some of them were rejuved, like her, had known her for years, knew the score as well, too, she reckoned, as well as any of them knew it. Bitter to them that this critical phase was not theirs, could not be. She walked the dark limbo of the forward hold, round the cylinder rim, into the either-way world of the ridership cruise, a place like home, a memory of other days when she had had her quarters in such a place, this bizarre section where the crews of the in-system fighters, their mechanics, prep crews, lived in their own private world. A whole other command existed here, right way up at the moment, under rotation, sealing down the rare times they were docked. Two of the eight crews were here, Quevedos and Omarshads of Odin and Thor. Four were off-duty, two were rotting null up in the frame. Or inside their ships, because locking crews through the special lift out of the rotation cylinder took one rotation of the hull, and they could not spare that time if they jumped into trouble. Riding null through jump, she recalled that experience well enough. Not the pleasantest way to travel, but it was always someone's job. They had no intent to deploy the riders here at Omicron, or two more sets of them would have been set up there in the can, as they called it, in that exile. All that it should be, she said to those in demi-prep. Rest, relax, keep off the liquor. We're still on standby, and we'll be while we're here. Don't know when we'll be ordered out or with how much warning. Could have to scramble, but far from likely. My guess is we don't make mission jump without some time for rest. This operation is on our timetable, not Union's. There was no quibble. She took the lift up to main level, walked the shorter distance around to number one corridor, her legs still rubbery, but the drugs were losing their numbing effect. She went to her own office quarters, paced the floor a time, finally lay down on the cot and rested, just to shut her eyes and let the tension ebb, the nervous energy that jump always threw into her, because usually it meant coming out into combat, snapping decisions rapidly, kill or die. Not this time. This was the planned one, the thing to which they had been moving for months of small strikes, raids that had taken out vital installations, that had harried and destroyed where possible. Rest a while. Sleep if they could. She could not. She was glad when the summons came. It was a strange feeling to stand again in the corridors of Europe, stranger still to find herself in the company of all the others seated in the flagship's council room. An eerie and panicky feeling, this meeting of all of them who had been working together unmet these many years, who had so zealously avoided each other's vicinities except for brief rendezvous for the passing of orders ship to ship. In recent years, it was unlikely that Maisie and himself had known where all his fleet was, whether particular ships survived the missions on which they were sent, or what mad operations they might be undertaking solo. They had been less a fleet than a guerrilla operation, skulking and striking and running. Now they were here, the last 10, the survivors of the maneuvers. Herself, Tom Edger of Australia, lean and grim-faced. Big Mika Kreshoff of Atlantic, perpetually scowling. Carlo Mendez of North Pole, a small, dark man of quiet manner. There was Channel of Libya, who had gone on rejuve. His hair had turned entirely silver since she had seen him a year ago. There was dark-skinned Pori of Africa, an incredibly grim man. Cosmetic surgery after wounds was not available in the fleet. Q of India, silk-soft and confident. Sung of Pacific, all efficiency. Kant of Tibet, another of Sung's stamp. And Conrad Mazian, silver-haired with rejuve, a tall, handsome man in dark blue, who leaned his arms on the table and swept a slow glance over them. It was intended for effect. Possibly it was sincere affection, that open look. Dramatic sense and Mazian were inseparable. The man lived by it. Knowing him, knowing the manner of him, Signy still found herself drawn in by the old excitement. No preliminaries, no statement of welcome, just that look and a nod. "Folders are in front of you," Mazian said. "Closest security. Codes and coordinates are in those. Carry them back with you and familiarize your key personnel with the details, but don't discuss anything ship to ship. Key your comps for alternatives A, B, C, and so on, and go to them by that according to the situation. But we don't reckon to be using those alternatives. Things are set up as they should be. Schematic. He called an image to the screen before them, showed them the familiar area of their recent operations, which by stripping away vital personnel and leaving chaos on the station's left, one lone, untampered station like the narrowing of a funnel toward Pell, toward the wide straggle of Hinderstars. One station. Viking. Signy had figured the pattern long since, the tactic old as Earth, old as war, impossible for Union to resist, for they could not allow vacuum and power, could not allow the stations they had struggled to gain to fall into disorder, plundered of technicians and directors and security forces, deliberately allowed to collapse. Union had started this game of station-taking, so they had rammed stations down Union's throat. Union had then to move in or have stations lost, had to supply techs and other skilled personnel to replace the ones evacuated, and ships to guard them quickly, one after the other. Union had had to stretch even its monster capacity to hold what it had been given to digest. It had had to take Viking whole, with all the internal complications of a station never evacuated, take it latest, because by ramming stations down Union's gullet in their own rapid sequence, they had dictated the sequence and direction of Union's moves of ships and personnel. Viking had been last. Central to the others, with desolation about it, stations struggling to survive. All indication is, Mazian said softly, that they have decided to fortify Viking. Logical choice. Viking is the only one with its comp files complete, the only one where they've had a chance to round up all the dissidents, all the resistance, where they could apply their police tactics and card everyone instantly. Now it's all clean, all sanitary for their base of operations. We've let them throw a lot into it. We take out Viking and hit at the others that are hanging by a thread in terms of viability, and then there's nothing but far waste between us and Fargon, between Pell and Union. We make expansion inconvenient, costly. We herd the beast to its wider pastures in the other direction, while we can. You have your specific instructions in the folders. The fine details may have to be improvised within certain limits, according to what might turn up in your sectors. Norway, Libya, India, Unit 1. Europe, Tibet, Pacific, 2. North Pole, Atlantic, Africa, 3. Australia has its own business. If we're lucky, we won't face anything at our rear, but every contingency is covered. This is going to be a long session. That's why I let you rest. We'll simulate until there are no more questions. Sydney drew a slow breath and released it, opened the folder, and in the silence Mazian afforded them to do so, scanned the operation as it was set up, her lips pressed to a thinner and thinner line. No need for drill. They knew what they were about, variations on old themes they had all run separately. But this was navigation that would try all their skill, a mass strike, a precision of arrival not synced but separate, disaster if jump ships came near each other, if an object of mass like the enemy just happened to be in the vicinity. They were going to flash in close enough to Viking to give the opposition no options, skin the hair off disaster. The presence of any enemy ship where it statistically ought not to be, the deployment of ships out from station in unusual configurations, all manner of contingencies. They took into account, too, the position of worlds and satellites in the system on their arrival date to screen themselves where possible. To flash out of jump space with nerves still sluggish, to haul dazed minds into action and try to plot instantly the location of friend and enemy, to coordinate an attack so precisely that some of them were going to overjump Viking and some underjump it, come in from all sides at once from the same start. They had one advantage over Union's sleek new ships, the fine equipment, the unscarred young crews, tape-trained, deep-taught with all the answers. The fleet had experience, could move their patched ships with a precision Union's fine equipment had not yet matched, with nerve Union conservatism and adherence to the book discouraged in its captains. They might lose a carrier in this kind of operation, maybe more than one, come jolting in too close, take each other out. The odds were in favor of its happening. They rode Mazian's luck that it would not. That was their edge, that they would do what no one sane could do, and shock aided them. The schematics appeared, one after the other. They argued, for the most part listened and accepted, for there was little to which they wished to object. They shared a meal, returned to the briefing room, argued the last round. "One day for rest," Mazian said. "We go at main dawn, day after tomorrow. Set it up in comp. Check and double-check." They nodded, parted company, each to his own ship, and there was a peculiar flavor to the parting as well, that when next they met, they would be fewer. "See you in hell," Channel muttered, and Puri grinned. A day to get it all into comp, and the appointment was waiting. Chapter 5. Citeen Station Security Area, 9:14:52. Ayres awoke, not sure what had wakened him in the quiet of their apartments. Marsh had gotten back, the latest fright they had had, when he failed to rejoin them after recreation. Tension afflicted Ayres. He realized that for some time he had slept tense, for his shoulders hurt and his hands were clenched, and he lay still now with sweat gathered on his face, not sure what had caused it. The war of nerves had not ceased. Azov had what he wanted, a message calling Mazian in. They quibbled now over some points of secondary agreements for the future of Pell, which Jacoby professed to hand to Union. They had their recreation time, that much, but they were detained in conferences, harassed by petty tactics the same as before. It was as if all his appeal to Azov had only aggravated the situation, for Azov was not accessible for the last 5 days. Gone, the lesser authorities insisted, and the difficulties raised for them now had the taint of malice. Someone was astir outside. Soft footsteps. The door slid back unannounced. Diaz's silhouette leaned into it. "Sigist," she said. "Come. You must come. It's Marsh." He rose and reached for his robe, then followed Diaz. Carl Bela was stirring him from his room likewise, next door to him. Marsh's room was across the sitting room, next to Diaz's, and the door was open. Marsh hung, gently turning by his belt looped from a hook which had held a movable light. The face was horrible. Ayres froze an instant, then dragged back the chair which had slid on its track, climbed up and tried to get the body down. They had no knife, had nothing with which they might cut the belt. It was embedded in Marsh's throat, and he could not get it free and support the body at once. Bela and Diaz tried to help, holding the knees, but that was no good. "We've got to call security," Diaz said. Ayres climbed down from the chair, hard breathing, stared at them. "I might have stopped him," Diaz said. "I was still awake. I heard them moving about, a great deal of noise, then strange sounds. When they had stopped so suddenly and so long, I finally got up to see." Ayres shook his head, looked at Bela, then stalked out to the sitting room and the comm panel by the door, punched through a request to security. "One of us is dead," he said. "Put me through to someone in charge." "Request will be relayed," the answer came back. "Security is on its way." The contact went dead, no more informative than usual. Ayres sat down, head in hands, tried not to think of Marsh's horrible corpse slowly spinning in the next compartment. It had been coming. He had feared worse, that Marsh would break down in his tormentor's hands. A brave man, after his own fashion, he had not broken. Ayres tried earnestly to believe that he had not. Or guilt, perhaps? Remorse might have driven him to suicide. Diaz and Bela sat down nearby, waited with him, faces stark and somber, hair disordered from sleep. He tried to comb his own with his fingers. Marsh's eyes. He did not want to think of them. A long time passed. "What's keeping them?" Bela wondered, and Ayres recovered sense enough to glance up harshly at Bela, reprimand for that show of humanity. It was the old war. It continued even in this, especially after this. "Maybe we should go back to bed," Diaz said. At other times, in other places, a mad suggestion. Here it was sanity. They needed their rest. A systematic effort was being made to deprive them of it. A little more, and they would all be like Marsh. "Probably they will be late," he agreed aloud.
We might as well. They quietly, as if it were the sanest thing in the world, retired to their separate rooms. Ayres took off his robe and hung it over the chair by his bed, reckoning anew that he was proud of his companions, who held up so well, and that he hated, hated Union. It was not his business to hate, only to get results. Marsh, at least, was free. He wondered what Union did with their dead. Ground them up, perhaps, for fertilizer. That would be typical of such a society, economical. Poor Marsh. It was guaranteed that Union would be perverse. He had no sooner settled into bed, reduced his mind to a level that excluded clear thought, closed his eyes in an attempt at sleep, than the outer door whisked open, the tread of booted feet sounded in the sitting room, his door was rudely pulled back, and armed soldiers stood silhouetted against the light. With studied calm, he rose to his feet. "Dress," a soldier said. He did so. There was no arguing with the mannequins. "Ayres," the soldier said, motioning with his rifle. They had been moved out of the apartment to one of the offices, he and Bela and Diaz, made to sit for at least an hour on hard benches, waiting for someone of authority who was promised them. Presumably security needed to examine the apartment in detail. "Ayres," the soldier said a second time, this time harshly, indicating that he should rise and follow. He did so, leaving Diaz and Bela with a touch of apprehension in the parting. They would be bullied, he thought, perhaps even accused of Marsh's murder. He was about to be, perhaps. Another means of breaking their resistance, only, he thought. He might be in Marsh's place. He was the one separated from the others. He was taken out of the office, brought among a squad of soldiers in the outer corridor, hastened farther and farther from the offices, from all the ordinary places, taken down in a lift, marched along another hall. He did not protest. If he stopped, they would carry him. There was no arguing with these mentalities, and he was too old to submit to being dragged down a hall. It was the docks. The docks, crowded with military, squad upon squad of armed troops and ships loading. "No," he said, forgetting all his policy, but a rifle barrel slammed against his shoulders and moved him on, across the ugly utilitarian decking, up to the ramp and umbilical, which linked some ship to the dock. Inside, then, the air was, if anything, colder than it was on the docks. They passed three corridors, a lift, numerous doors. The door at the end was open and lighted, and they brought him in, into the steel and plastic of shipboard furnishings, sloping shapes, chairs of ambiguous design, fixed benches, decks of far more obvious curve than those at the station, everything cramped and angles strange. He staggered, unused to the footing, looked in surprise at the man seated at the table. Dayan Jacoby rose from a chair to welcome him. "What's going on?" he asked of Jacoby. "I really don't know," Jacoby told him, and it seemed the truth. "I was roused out last night and brought aboard. I've been waiting in this place half an hour." "Who's in charge here?" Ayres demanded of the mannequins. "Inform him I want to speak with him." They did nothing, only stood, rifles braced all at the same drill angle. Ayres slowly sat down, as Jacoby did. He was frightened. Perhaps Jacoby himself was. He lapsed into his long habit of silence, finding nothing to say to a traitor at any event. There was no polite conversation possible. The ship moved, a crash echoing through the hull and the corridors and disturbing them from their calm. Soldiers reached for handholds as the movement of Queasy Null came on them. Freed of station's grav, they had a moment yet to acquire their own as ship systems took over. Clothes crawled unpleasantly, stomachs churned. They were convinced of imminent falling, and the falling when it came was a slow settling. "We've left," Jacoby muttered. "It's come, then." Ayres said nothing, thinking in panic of Bela and Diaz, left behind. Left. A black-clad officer appeared in the doorway, and another behind him. Azov. "Dismissed," Azov said to the mannequins, and they went out in silent order. Ayres and Jacoby rose at once. "What's going on?" Ayres asked directly. "What is this?" "Citizen Ayres," said Azov.
We are on defensive maneuvers.
My companions, what about them?
They are in a most secure place, Mr. Ayers. You've provided us the message we desired. It may prove of use, and therefore you're with us. Your quarters are adjoining, just down that corridor. Kindly confine yourself there.
What's happening? He demanded, but the aide took him by the arm and escorted him to the door.
He seized the frame and resisted, casting a look back at Azov.
What's happening?
We are preparing, Azov said, to deliver Maisie and your message, and it seems fit for you to be at hand, if further questions are raised.
The attack is coming, I make my guess where, and that it will be a major one. Maisian doesn't give up stations for nothing.
And we're going, Mr. Ayers, to put ourselves where he has obliged us to stand, up to the wager, as it were. He's left us no choice, and he knows it. But, of course, it's earnestly to be hoped that he will regard the authority you have to recall him. Should you wish to prepare a second, even more forceful message, facilities will be provided you, to be edited by your experts.
Azov smiled tautly.
Do you want the fleet intact?
Frankly, I doubt you can recover it.
I don't think Maisian will regard your message, but as he finds himself deprived of bases, you may yet have a humanitarian role to fill.
Ayers said nothing. He reckoned silence, even now, the wisest course.
The aide took him by the arm and drew him back down the corridor, showed him into a barren compartment of plastic furniture, and locked the door.
He paced a time, what few paces the compartment allowed.
In time, he yielded to the weariness in his knees and sat down.
He had managed badly, he thought. Diaz and Bela were, wherever they were, on a ship or still on a station, and what station they had been on, he still did not know.
Anything might happen.
He sat shivering, suddenly realizing that they were lost, that soldiers and ships were aimed at Pal and Maisian, for Jacoby was brought along too. Another humanitarian function. In his own stupidity, he had played to stay alive, to get home. It looked less and less likely. They were about to lose it all.
A peace has been concluded, he had said in a simple statement he had permitted to be recorded, lacking essential codes.
Security Council Representative Sigist Ayers, by authority of the Earth Company, and the Security Council requests the fleet make contact for negotiation.
It was the worst of all times for a major battle to be joined. Earth needed Maisian where he was, with all his ships, striking at random at Union, a nuisance, making it difficult for Union to extend its arm earthward.
Maisian had gone mad. Against Union's vast extent, to launch the few ships he had, and to engage on a massive scale and lose. If the fleet was wiped out, then Earth was suddenly out of the time he had come here to win. No Maisian, no Pell, and everything fell apart.
And might not a message of the sort he had framed provoke some rash action, or confound maneuvers already in progress, lessening the chance of Maisian's success even further?
He rose, paced again the bowed floor of what looked to be his final prison.
A second message, then. An outrageous demand. If Union was as self-convinced as the mannequins, as humorlessly convinced of their purpose, they might let it pass if it fit their demands.
Considering merger of company interest with Union in trade agreements, he composed in his head. Negotiations far advanced. As earnest of good faith in negotiations, cease all military operations, cease fire and accept truce. Stand by for further instructions.
Treachery. To drive Maisian into retreat, into the kind of scattered resistance Earth needed at this stage. It was the only hope.
Book 3. Chapter 1, Part 1. In approach to Pal, 10:04:52, 11:45 hours. Pal. Norway moved as the fleet moved, hurling their mass into real space in sync. Calm and Scan flurried into action, searching for the moat, which was Giant Tibet, which had jumped in before them, advance guard in this route.
Affirmative. Calm sent to command with comforting swiftness.
Tibet was where she was supposed to be, intact, probe untouched by any hostile activity. Ships were scattered about the system, commerce quickly evaporating bluster from some self-claimed militia. Tibet had had one merchanter skip out in panic, and that was bad news. They needed no tale-bearers running to Union,
but possibly that was the last place a merchanter wanted to head at the moment. And a moment later, confirmation snapped out from Europe, from the flagship's operations. They were in safe space with no action probable. Getting calm out of Pellet South now, Graf relayed to her post at controls, still listening. Sounds good. Signy reached across the board and keyed signal to the rider captains, advising them. Fast to Norway's hull, so many parasites they did not kick loose. Calm was receiving direct and frantic IDs from the militia ships, scrambling out of their projected course if they came in-system dangerously fast, out-of-system plane. The fleet itself was more than nervous, running as they were in one body, probing their way into the last secure area they hoped to have left. They were nine now. Channel's Libya was debris and vapor, and Q's India had lost two of its four riders. They were in full retreat, had run from the debacle at Viking, seeking a place to draw breath. They all had scars. Norway had a vein trailing a cloud of metallic viscera, if they still had the vein at all after jump. They were dead aboard, three techs who had not been in that section. They had not had time to vent them, not even to clean up the area, had run, saved the ship, the fleet, such as remained of company power. Signy's board still flashed with red lights. She passed the order to damage control to dispose of the corpses, whatever of them they could find. Here, too, there might have been an ambush. Was not, would not be. She stared at the lights in front of her, looked at the board, with the drug still weighting her senses, numbing her fingers as she manipulated controls to take back Norway's governance from Comp Sync. They had scarcely engaged at Viking, had turned tail and run, Maisian's decision. She had never questioned, had respected the man for strategic genius, for years. They had lost a ship, and he had pulled them, after months of planning, after maneuvers that had taken 4 months and unreckoned lives to set up. Had pulled them from a fight from which their nerves were still jangled, from a fight which they could have won. She had not the heart to look beside her to meet Graf's eyes, or Di's, or the faces of the others on the bridge, and no answer for them. Had none for herself. Maisian had another idea, something. She was desperate to believe that there was sane reason for the abort. Get out quickly, redo it, replan it. Only this time they had been pushed out of all their supply lines, had given up all the stations from which they had drawn goods. It was possible Maisian's nerve had broken. She insisted otherwise to herself, but reckoned inwardly what moves she would have called, what she would have done in command of the fleet. What any of them could have done better than had been done. Everything had worked according to plan, and Maisian had aborted. Maisian, that they worshipped. Blood was in her mouth. She had bitten her lip through. Receiving approach instructions from Pell via Europe, Calm told her. Graf, she said, take it over. She reserved her own attention to the screens and the emergency comm link she had plugged into her ear, direct link with Maisian when he should decide finally to use it, when he should decide to communicate with the fleet, which he had not, silent since the orders which had hurled them out of a battle they had not lost. It was a routine approach, all routine. She received clearance through Maisian's comm, keyed the order to her rider captains, scattering Norway's fighters as other ships of the fleet were shedding their own, backup crews manning them this time. The riders would keep an eye on the militia, blast any that threatened to bolt, then come and dock to them after the great carriers were safely berthed at station. Calm chatter continued out of Pell. Go slow, station pleaded with them. Pell was a crowded vicinity. There was nothing for Maisie and himself. Part 2. Pell, Blue Dock, 1200 hours. Maisian himself, and not Union, not another convoy. The whole fleet was coming in. Word ran through the station corridors with the speed of every uncontrolled channel, through the station offices and the smallest gathering on the docks, through Q as well, for there were leaks at the barriers, and screens showed the situation there. Emotion ran from outright panic while there had been the possibility of Union ships, to panic of a different flavor when they knew it for what it was. Damon studied the monitors and intermittently paced the floors of Dock Command Blue. Aline was there, seated at the comm console, holding the plug to her ear and frowning in concentrated dispute with someone. Merchanters were in a state of panic.
The militarized ones were an impulse away from bolting entirely, in dread of being swept up by the fleet, crews and ships as well, impressed to service. Others dreaded confiscation of supplies, of arms, of equipment and personnel. Such fears and complaints were his concern. He talked to some of them, when he could offer any assurance. Legal affairs were supposed to prevent such confiscations by injunction, by writs and decrees. Decrees against Mazian. Merchanters knew what that was worth. He paced and fretted, finally went to Com and took another channel, contacting security. "Dean," he hailed the man in charge. "Call me Alter Day Shift. If we can't pull them off queue, we still can't leave those freighter docks open to easy intrusion. Put some live bodies in the way. Uniform some of the supervisory staff if you haven't enough. General call-up, get those docks secure and make sure you keep the downers out of there." "Your office authorizes it." "It authorizes it." There was hesitation on the other end. There were supposed to be papers, counter-signatures from the main office. Station Master could do it. Station Master's office had its hands full trying to make sense out of the situation. His father was on comm trying to stall off the fleet with argument. "Get me a signed paper when you can," Dean Gahan said. "I'll get them there." Damon breathed a soft hiss, shut down the contact, paced more, paused again behind Aline's chair, leaning on the back of it. She leaned back in a moment's lull, half turned to touch his hand. Her face had been white when he had come into the room. She had recovered her color and her composure. Tex kept busy, dispensing the finer details of orders to the dock crews below, preparations for Station Central to start shifting freighters out of berth to accommodate the fleet. Chaos. There were not only freighters in dock. There were 100 merchanters assigned permanent orbit with the station about down below, a drifting cloud of freighters for which there had been no room. 9 ships of vast size were moving in on that, sending ships off dock out into it. Mazian's comm was firing a steady catechism of questions and authorizations at Pell, as yet refusing to specify what he wanted or where he meant to dock, if he meant to dock at all. Us next? The nightmare was with them. Evacuation. Pregnancy was no state in which to contemplate a refugee journey to God knew where, through Jump, to some long-abandoned Hinderstar station, to Sol, to Earth. He thought of Hansford, thought of Aline in that. Of what had been civilized men when they started. "Maybe we won," Attack said. He blinked, realized that too for a possibility, but not possible. They had always known at heart that it was impossible, that Union had grown too big, that the fleet could give them years as it had until now, but not victory, never that. The carriers would not have come in this number, not for any other reason than retreat. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.